العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أمى رائزك لتصي دليلتك وانسك.
فيلم فيخ از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه و جورسپرودنس is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
اما برای کسانی که عقلشون رو به کار بیاندازن.
The term Ulul Albab in Ayah 190 of Surah Al Imran means those who possess intellect. Now, the concept of possessing intellect does not mean simple understanding of the signs of Allah. This means that intellect possessors contemplate on the creation of Allah. Now, there are some people who have knowledge about the solar system and understand the order that exists on the earth and other planets. However, they do not contemplate on that and have a scientific look at it merely without connecting it to a higher almighty power. Such people are not considered intellect possessors according to the Quran.
اما ارتباط این رو با اون کسی که میگردونه اینا رو
اول الالباب are those who can connect all these orderly manners to Allah. In other words, the real lob or wisdom is for those who think about the higher power who created this. If people leave their biases, disagreements, ignorance and enmities, then they will be able to find out the true source behind all the creations on the galaxy. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khala of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/Ian, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Ocean of Dua.
Thumma inni as'aluka al-huda wat-tuqa wal-'afafa wal-ghina.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance and also benefits of dua. So stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil
As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, we were talking about the different levels of love, the different manifestations, and different signs of true love. We talked about the most pure and sincere form of love, hope, and aspiration, which does not depart from the heart of the servant of the Almighty Allah, even if he is tied in his chains, deprived of the favors of the Almighty Allah, and his misdeeds disclosed by him before the people. We read to you the true meaning of love, the true manifestation of love, in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the supplication of Kumail. Now let us continue to study the remarkable forms of love and hope described by this Imam in this supplication. Imam alayhi salam says, "By your might, O my master and my protector, I swear sincerely that if you were to leave me with speech, I would lament before you from the midst of the inhabitants of the fire with the lamentation of the hopeful. I would cry to you with the cry of those crying for help. I would weep before you with the weeping of the bereft. I would call upon you, 'Where are you, O sponsor of the believers, O goal of the hopes of your knowers, O aid of those who seek assistance, friend of the hearts of the sincere, and Lord of the worlds. Tell me, glory be to you, O Allah, and yours is the praise.'"
رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ.
Can you hear the fire of the voice of a slave imprisoned in it because of his disobedience, suffering the pangs of its torment because of his wrongdoings, and confined within its levels because of his sin and crime, while he still laments before you with the lament of the one hopeful of your mercy, calls upon you with the tongue of those who profess your oneness, and entreats you by your lordship? So what in fact Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about is the true love. And you can see that Imam alayhi salam is talking about that brilliant gesture of love that we talked about previously. This is a kind of person that would never forget the separation. Imam alayhi salam says, "Far it be from you. That is not what is expected of you, nor what is well known of your grace, nor it is similar to the goodness and kindness you have shown to those who have professed your oneness. So I declare with certainty that were it not for what you have decreed about punishing your deniers, and what you have decided about making those who stubbornly resist your abide forever, you would have made the fire, all of it, cool and safe, and no one would have had a place, an abode in it."
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala va pas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Some divine men believe that bravery, all of it, stemmed from the very person of Imam Ali alayhi salam, such that they do not part him even during prayers before the Lord of the worlds. And here you can see, he is imagining in the supplication of Kumail that the fire has embraced a sinful servant and surrounded him from all sides. Still, he does not stay quiet and submit to the chastisement, as in the case with the who has been encircled by the punishment and surrounded by keepers. Rather, he laments, he cries out, he shouts, he calls out that I need not to be separated from you. The only thing I care about is separation from you. The only thing I want to have is my closeness to you. So you see how he describes this situation while invoking Allah. He says, "By your might, O my master, I swear sincerely that if you were to leave me with speech, I would lament before you from the midst of the inhabitants of the fire with lamentation of the hopeful. And I would cry to you with the cry of those crying for help. I would weep before you with the weeping of the bereft. And I would call upon you, where are you, O sponsor of the believers?" So you see, this bravery is stemming from the true love Imam Ali alayhi salam has got in his heart. And what we told you previously, that the true love makes the jawarih, those bodily parts of the person, move towards the beloved. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: كانوا قبل نوح أمة واحدة على فطرة الله، لا مهتدين ولا ضلالا، فبعث الله النبيين.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Before Prophet Noah, the mankind were the single community upon the fitrah, neither guided nor in error. Thereafter, Allah sent the prophets."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find a very beautiful conversation between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and one of his most knowledgeable students by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi. In this conversation, Imam al-Baqir gives some very immortal commandments which are full of great ideals, moral standards, knowledge, and wisdom through which any human being can become perfect, can rise to the heights of perfection and be sublime in their life if and when they put them into effect. Now, one of the things which was said in this dialogue is as follows. Imam al-Baqir says, "Close up the way of conceit through knowing the soul. Get to the rest of the soul through the soundness of authorization. Seek the rest of the body through giving rest to the soul. Come to the rest of the soul through asking for forgiveness from our sins. Seek the mercy of the heart through the praise of Allah, which should be done very much and in private. Finally, bring the light of the soul through the continuity of sadness." And so here, dear friends, Imam al-Baqir is telling us that know the soul, and when you know what the soul is, you will close up the way of conceit and find rest of your body by giving rest to your soul. Be at peace in your soul. When the soul is at peace, the body will also be at peace. And how is it that the soul gains peace? Is by asking for forgiveness from our sins, from being grateful to Allah for all that He has given us. And how do we seek the mercy of Allah? By praising Allah, by glorifying Allah as much as we can, as much as we can remember, and especially so in private. And finally, bringing the light of the soul is by the continuity of sadness, not sadness about our lives, but perhaps sadness that we could have done so much more, we could have done so many more good deeds, and we could have done so many fewer bad deeds. We could have been such better people. And with this sadness in our heart, we then become motivated to become better people in our lives. Beautiful words exchanged between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and his esteemed teacher, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now let's listen to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who's going to talk about today's topic.
And so I would like to talk a little bit about the historical conditions that surrounded this great imam and see what lessons we can learn from him and in the struggles that he had to face. Many of the Shia before the Imam were practicing a kind of a mixed type of fiqh, where they would be following proto-Sunni elements and also based upon what teachings came to them from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. One of the reasons why the Shia were so in disarray is because most of the knowledgeable people were killed in Karbala, and also after that among the penitents, the Tawabun, that rose up against the Bani Umayyah. And so, for example, you found that Shias in, for example, Kufa were following the teachings of the Ahlul Hadith, who were largely based upon the fatwa of Omar. And so you have hadith, for example, where one person is saying, I went to Imam Muhammad Baqir about wiping on the shoes. You know, for many of our Sunni brothers, where they do wudu over the socks, right, over the leather socks. And the Imam said to him, you don't do this because this is not something that Imam Ali alayhi salam did. What is in the book is in the book, in the Holy Quran, and what they are doing is something that comes after the Holy Quran. And you found many, many cases of things like this, where the Imam explicates and clarifies the fiqh of the Shia. We find, for example, in also things like theology, the Imam is also very, very explicit and teaching the Shia the proper way of thinking on a theological basis. Not only was he knowledgeable and famous for his knowledge among the Shia, but he was also famous for his knowledge among the Sunnis as well. And so you find that in many, many of the Sunni books, they mention him as a source of many a hadith. In one narration, he says, sometimes I mention a hadith and I don't say the chain of transmission, but the chain of transmission goes through me, goes through my father, goes through my grandfather, my great-grandfather, up to the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
European News Bulletin.
My name is Amina Taylor, and we are broadcasting from London. So we start with what's being dubbed V-Day. Just 10 months since the COVID-19 pandemic hit, a vaccine is being administered outside a clinical trial here in the United Kingdom. Now, this is the beginning of a mass inoculation initiative that Britain and indeed the whole world hope will signal the beginning of the end of this pandemic. But has the government built enough trust with the public? Bianca Rahimi finds out in this report.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week,
has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened. And now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation, but we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional by that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes me proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly, like the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines. Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, Lembit Opik, the former MP and political commentator, is with us. And Lembit, as somebody who perhaps is still feeling the impact of COVID that you contracted just a couple weeks ago, Pfizer has been given legal protection by the government. Does that make you feel a little bit more easy in the mind?
First of all, I wish this vaccine had existed 2 months ago so that I could avoid the worst November I've had in decades. I'm recovering from the disease now, and there's no doubt if we have a successful vaccine, that's great. My concern is the one that's been expressed in your piece there. There's always going to be a risk if you rush something which is biologically significant to the human body, that you have unforeseen side effects, unforeseen circumstances which cause other problems. Now, what's the balance here? In reality, I think it's probably better that they do this. But let's recognize there's a political dimension here as well. Britain wanted to be the first in the world to implement the vaccine. They've achieved that with 800,000 vaccines being rolled out now. But there is still that small risk. I think it's probably a risk worth taking.
Now, of course, they won't be mandatory at the moment, but things like traveling and other essential elements of life might require a vaccine passport. What are your thoughts on that?
In the short term, it makes sense if you want to limit the impact not just of people coming into the United Kingdom with the disease, but also people going from the United Kingdom, which is a very high disease risk area in terms of the world at the moment, so that we don't spread it to other countries. So in that sense, having a vaccine passport makes sense. But once again, I'm concerned about the long-term implications here. Britons have given away a lot of freedom voluntarily, by and large, because they've been good corporate citizens, they've wanted to prevent death. But these precedents, if they become rather more restrictive, we could end up in a country where we have biological authoritarianism, where the vaccines become mandatory, you can't travel if you haven't got one. Then we begin to have a civil liberties debate, not one for tonight, but it's one we will certainly return to if this is used as a precedent outside this pandemic.
So will a beleaguered Boris Johnson be breathing a bit easier tonight, Limpet?
He will be, but he ought to be a bit careful here. A recent YouGov poll puts him at having 34% approval ratings and 58% against him. His party is level pegging with the Labour Party, very close together. He needs this to work. The truth is, Amina, that if this vaccine shows a massive decline in the disease, he'll get the benefit from that. But it's also, in some ways, a junk bond. The value of his credibility can go down as well as up. And if there is some terrible byproduct of this, which causes different infections, then he'll get hurt by it. He's had to put all his eggs in this basket. The country didn't want to go into 2021 with no hope. But frankly, his political fortunes are probably absolutely intimately connected with the success of this and the other vaccines. That means he's actually handed his future to pharmaceuticals.
Indeed, Lambert Opik, thank you, as always. Now we move on to the European Union, where they've rejected the results of Venezuela's parliamentary elections. This saw the President Nicolas Maduro's political alliance win some 67% of the seats. More than 14,000 candidates representing 100 or so political parties took part in the election, despite opposition parties, including U.S.-backed Juan Guaido, the former leader of the National Assembly, boycotting the vote. Now, the statement falls in line of that of Washington's. They've also rejected the elections, despite no attempt to concur with international regulators and observers. Western powers are keen to overthrow the socialist government of Nicolas Maduro and have attempted three unsuccessful coups in the past year. Now with us, Isaac Bijou, the political commentator. He's with here for his reactions. Isaac, hi. You surprised by the EU stance here and that it so clearly mirrors that of Washington?
No, because the European Union has been following what the United States is doing. And perhaps one person can think, oh, now we are seeing that Donald Trump is accusing his own system as fraudulent, and that even Chavez, after being dead, has been able to manipulate the results against him, that the European Union could change. They didn't change. The same day as Venezuela had elections, Romania had elections, and they also had one-third of electors to participate. So the same as Venezuela, but they don't criticize Romania, they only criticize Venezuela. Some European elections have less participation than in Venezuela. Most of the local elections in the United Kingdom and many parliamentarian by-elections have one-third or less of participation, but they don't accuse that of fraudulent. In the Venezuelan election, we have more than 100 parties, most of them from the opposition. You have different right-wing opposition and even a left-wing opposition. But I think that the European Union is always going to follow what Washington says.
And very briefly on this one, Isaac, the U.S., we know, has directly backed multiple coups in just a matter of the last 18 months or so. How can they talk about free and fair polls?
Have you seen Donald Trump accusing his own system as fraudulent? The United States has supported every single dictatorship in Latin America in the last 70 years. None of them has been punished by the Organization of American States. But in Venezuela, they removed the Venezuela from the Organization of American States. They recognized Guaido, a guy that had never been elected by anybody. He couldn't stand in this election because he was not going to have any single vote. In Catalonia, they rejected a referendum organized by the Catalan government.
Indeed.
Despite that 40% of the population vote. But now in Venezuela, they reject a national election and they wanted to implement a referendum which nobody is going to vote. I think that is a double standard. When they want somebody to be punished because this government is against the United States,
indeed,
they will punish the government. If it is a government that supports the United States, they will follow that route.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you, as always. Now we move on to Britain here, where the country's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has labelled the latest rounds of Brexit talks as difficult, further adding that the UK would have to decide very soon if there was indeed going to be a no-deal Brexit. With just over 3 weeks before Britain completes its journey out of the bloc, significant differences still remain over trade, state aid and fisheries. And if an agreement is not reached by the 31st of December, the UK and the EU could introduce import charges on each other's goods. Prime Minister Johnson's comments comes just a day after he and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen spoke on the phone and agreed significant differences on key issues remained. The pair have scheduled to meet in person in the next, quote, coming days.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Richard Sudan, Priti Patel, Britain's Home Secretary. Well, is she covering herself in some more glory there?
Well, I mean, we're learning now, Amina, just days after the UK Home Office and Priti Patel went ahead with a number of deportations. The deportees, we believe, were directly related to the Windrush family. Of course, that was a scandal in itself, erupting 2 years ago. And now, just days after this, we find that the Home Office is set for another round of deportations of potential asylum seekers. And invariably, this has raised massive concerns to human rights lawyers and also watchdogs, who are saying that, you know, the government is going to come out with their usual line saying these people must be deported for X, Y, and Z. But experts are actually saying there are potentially people targeted by this move who themselves have been victims of trafficking, human trafficking, and other serious crimes, and they need to have their case further looked at before this decision can be made. In some ways, this doesn't surprise us, but of course, you know, we've become used to this kind of move from the Home Office, but human rights campaigners are understandably furious at the proposals, Amina.
And has this sentiment been reflected in the online reaction?
It certainly has. A lot of people keeping ahead of this issue now. John Brady says, I see Priti Patel is rushing the deportation of asylum seekers to beat the Brexit deadline. This includes people suspected to have been trafficked into the UK. This is the same Priti Patel who said, let the Irish starve during discussions on the impact of Brexit on food supplies. And we have a reaction from Andrea who says, men and women in Brexit Britain are unjustly detained and unlawfully deported. Windrush children suffer the deportation of their parents. The ethical and moral fabric of this country is deteriorating under government threats.
Well, I guess that's what they meant when they say take back control. To your other story now, unfortunately, Richard, whenever we speak, there seems to be just another tragedy. This time, once more coming out of the United States and the killing of another unarmed black man.
Another day and another black man dead at the hands of law enforcement, Amina. This time, 23-year-old Casey Goodson, who was shot in Ohio on Friday. Now, almost predictably, the police allege in their account of events that Casey Goodson was holding a gun. But get this, Amina. Casey's own family say he wasn't holding a gun. He was holding a sandwich, and he was actually shot three times in the back whilst entering his own home, front of his grandmother and also a sibling, you know, a child. And, you know, quite apart from the fact that Casey Goodson has had his life taken from him, I can't really imagine the trauma this would have sparked with his family. It's an almost unbelievable state of events. There's been a lot of celebration in recent weeks, you know, at the back of Donald Trump, as if this is the back of racism. But I mean,
Seeing that that's not the case at the moment, or perhaps it's just intensifying feelings in these volatile weeks before the inauguration. Can we move on to the social media reaction on this, Rich?
Sure, let's go to Starved Grounded, who says, Ohio police killed a 23-year-old black man who was walking into his own home with a Subway sandwich. Casey Goodson Jr., the police claim he was waving a gun, but he had a concealed carry license and the police shot him in the back. And Moonzy, also on Twitter, says, his name is Casey Goodson. He was just 23 and he was unjustly taken from his family and from the world. We demand that Franklin County Sheriff's Office takes charge and arrests Deputy Jason Mead and put him under trial for murder. We will not rest until we see justice.
We might have some bad news for Moonzy here, which in many of these cases, the officer is not charged. All right, Richard Sedat, we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you so much. So some other news now, where EU foreign ministers have begun evaluating grounds for sanctions against Turkey over its claims to hydrocarbon resources in the eastern Mediterranean. The EU's bloc's leaders will decide at a summit later on in the week on whether to make good on these waves of sanctions. Speaking on the East Med dispute, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey would not bow to threats and blackmail from the EU over its row with Greece. The president added that any plans or maps excluding Ankara from its rights in the eastern Mediterranean Sea were unacceptable. NATO member and EU candidate, Turkey claims gas resources that are also contested by Greece and Cyprus, a dispute that has had spawned territorial rows over maritime borders. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that concerns over human rights violations in Egypt would not affect the future sale of French arms to that country. Since 2015, France has sold considerable amounts of weapons to Egypt, with Macron voicing concerns that the country would turn to the West's rival, China and Russia, if it did not receive adequate support from Europe. Following Macron's press conference, over 20 human rights groups issued a statement condemning France's strategic partnership with Egypt. The statement accused the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, of human rights abuses in the country, including the cracking down of pro-democracy activists and supporters of his rival, Mohamed Morsi. Well, it seems a Saudi prince is breaking ranks when it comes to the occupation entity. Robert Inlakesh, more details, please.
Well, this is an interesting case, and it can be read in many different ways. So the statements which were made by the Saudi prince, Turki al-Faisal, of course, these are very accurate claims. He says that it's a Western colonizing power and that it operates concentration camps for Palestinians and it assassinates whoever it wants. These, are, of course, ring true to many ears, but unfortunately, we're looking at Saudi Arabia here, which does a very similar thing in Yemen. It's a close ally of the West and, of course, Israel. We know of the first meeting officially, which just occurred between the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Netanyahu, and also Secretary of State for the United States Mike Pompeo. What may have happened here, it could be taken a few different ways. Number one is that it looks like Saudi Arabia are quite enraged at the fact that Netanyahu leaked the fact that this secret meeting was supposed to be secret meeting Saudi Arabia, for one. They're not quite yet ready to normalize ties with Israel. And so perhaps this is sort of pulling away from them, and it's a way of them, you know, signaling that it's not time for them to normalize ties, that they're not ready to go ahead with this. It might be a saving face thing also. And on top of that as well, people have speculated as to whether this is something to do with Iran. Do they want to be seen as such an aggressive party against Iran on the front lines for Israel? Do the Saudis want to subject themselves to possible retaliatory strikes on Saudi Arabia if they formalize ties with Israel and start allowing Israel to even use their territory to commit massacres against Iran and to strike Iranian territory? Do they want to get tangled up in that? And of course, perhaps they do not want to get tangled up in such a thing. So this can be taken many different ways. But of course,
Robert Inlakesh, there could be the idea here that there's not a uniformity of positions inside the House of Saud, that there are actually members of the royal family who thinks this is a bad idea for a variety of reasons.
Absolutely. There is a difference of opinion. Even with the UAE normalization, there's many that were against it that just didn't voice their opinions. We've heard one of the opinions voiced here. And so it does show there's a divide in opinion here. However, Saudi Arabia continues, for instance, to crack down on Palestinians, behead Palestinians, imprison Palestinians for no good reason, of course, and crack down on the Hamas movement and put out false statements about the Hamas movement. So, you know, one Saudi prince stating that. Well, the first one we've got here is from a user called David. He says he's basically saying he says all of these things while sitting at the table at a panel with Gabi Ashkenazi, who's the foreign minister for Israel. And he says, lol. And we've got another one here from an Israeli who says they will never settle with the Jewish state. Maybe only for a short time when it suits their interests and if it's not public. I posted previously a photo proof of their anti-Israel training seminars, and that's interesting because, of course, there's many in Saudi Arabia that disapprove of this, and the Israelis are not friendly towards them on a general level.
And we move to your second story. Some interesting words coming out of Brussels for Tehran.
Absolutely. This one, just utter hypocrisy, trying to paint, you know, the JCPOA as an agreement where it's just a... an ask and deliver sort of negotiation here. They want Iran basically to hold up their side of the JCPOA when all the other sides have betrayed it. The United States unilaterally withdrew from it. Trump then slapped on these criminal sanctions, which amount to war crimes in some cases against Iran. And the Europeans have not held up their side of the bargain. And they have not gone as far as even attempting to punish Israel, not only for the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Iran's top scientist, but on top of that, Qasem Soleimani as well. Nothing has been done on the international stage for this. Whilst they're still doing weapons deals, for instance, with Saudi Arabia, with the Persian Gulf states, on, you know, unprecedented levels, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons flooding into that region. And they have the audacity to criticize Iran. Many are saying this is ridiculous. Israel has a stockpile of, it's estimated, about 300 nuclear weapons. They haven't signed the non-proliferation agreement. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, and it's enriching uranium for other purposes. It's stated as such. There's no one, no body on earth which will state that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And, of course, it's utter hypocrisy. Why wouldn't Iran even be able to obtain such a thing if it wanted to attain such a thing, for instance? This is just
very powerful responses to this claim.
The first one we have here is from Sayed Mohammed Marandi, who says in an interview on CNN, I stress that Iran won't accept any changes to the nuclear deal. Nothing will be added or renegotiated. The report implies that this is a bluster. This is a dangerous Western miscalculation. Iran didn't resist 4 years of Trump's barbarism to appease Biden. And then we have another one here that says, fool me once, shame on you, fool me, shame on me. Why should Iran waste time, effort, to entertain a one-sided deal only from for another few terms of seesaw political pantomime that ushers in another U.S. patsy that reneges on a deal lauded by honest Western nations? No thanks.
All right, Robert Inlakesh, thank you, as always. And this is where we leave you for this evening. Until next time, stay safe.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أول عوض الحليم من حلمه أن الناس أنصاره على الجاهل.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "The first reward the exerciser of forbearance gets is that people become his helpers against the ignorant."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this concept about being a student. It's really interesting. Many of us, if not all of us, have gone through school in one form or another, and we are all considered students. Some of us after high school or after college or university, perhaps a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, or even a doctorate degree, we then stop studying or we don't consider ourselves to be students anymore. But we learn a very interesting thing from Imam Ali alayhi salam, and that is the importance of being a student and the importance of being a student throughout our life. and not a student of, for example, the physical or chemical or biological sciences of the world, which in it of itself is nothing wrong, but to be a student of the Islamic sciences throughout our life. Now, as is evident and has been proved clearly for any and all unbiased